Pod. 22 Pod. In the city that sounds nice. Huh. Whereabouts are you based? Is it London?
Well, not quite. I'm just about a mile from Enfield. I'm in Cheshunt, which is in Hertfordshire. But there's a London Overground station just literally across the road from the house. So still connected, so to speak. Yeah.
Obviously, judging from your accent, that's not where you grew up then.
No, well, I don't know if you know, but I'm from Cork. I'm actually starting to look a bit like the other famous person from Cork, Roy Keane, because his beard is starting to get life of its own, you know? But yeah, when I get wound up, I sound like Roy Keane. No character, like, you know, what's our pride, you know?
It's nonsense.
Basics, you know? Yeah. I actually met him down in Bournemouth about 2 years ago. He was doing this thing, and my partner kind of organized it for Christmas present. And I had a good chat with him. And he was, I told him this anecdote about a book that I had. And the guys in my band got this book signed 20 years ago by him at this book signing. And in a fit of rage, former partner ripped it up. And I told him about it. And he says, she done that, what a bitch. We've got it on video of him saying that. It's so funny, you know. But yeah, he's actually a really nice guy. Yeah, seriously, he's a really nice fella, but he gets very, very heated, you know. I think that's like Cork people as well, you know. We're really good friends, but really bad enemies, you know. It's like Cork people, I don't know if you know about Irish, but Cork people are perceived to be different to the rest of Ireland. We have People's Republic of Cork t-shirts and stuff like that. You know, we're always the Cork people, they're always a bit different, you know.
Right. But,
yeah, so anyway, that's the long explanation as to why my accent is like this, you know. So,
yeah, fair. What event was it where you met? It was like a Q&A or something?
Yeah, it was like a meet and greet, and then there was this thing on where he was sitting on stage and answering questions, and we were sitting right at the front, and he just kept, every time something, because I was the only other person from Cork who was there, I think, and every time a question would be asked to him that he thought was ridiculous, he'd look down at me and shake his head, you know. it was really funny. Yeah.
I can imagine him appreciating people from Cork a lot more than other people, because I remember so he had like a love for Dennis Owen. Was he from Cork as well?
Yeah, he was. Yeah. Absolutely. You nailed it there. Like, absolutely. People from Cork have got a very sort of clan mentality. Do you know? Yeah. Stick together, boys. You know what I mean?
Like the build up to being in the band. Like, how did you go from that point to like getting that first single deal?
Well, the band started, I moved over to London in 97 and I got a job at a local newspaper group. One of them was an Irish newspaper in London. And the editor of the newspaper, this lady friend, and her son wanted to be a journalist. So he brought him in, he's only 17, to do some work experience. And I didn't know anyone else in London at the time. I just moved over and kind of developed a friendship with a similar taste in music, or at least enough, you know, overlap. And we kind of became friends, and we both had the idea we wanted to do music. So we just started jamming in his bedroom, you know, and then he brought his friend Phil in, who was based there, wanted to join. So then we got three people, and that's the kind of, you know, start the skeleton of a band, you know. But then they decided to go to Sheffield University. So the two of them went off, and then they, I thought it was the end of it. And then they met Andrew, try and keep it going. Or could already start kind of doing basic rehearsal sessions then. And then they got this drummer guy who wasn't really a drummer. And we just started, you know, bit by bit trying to get into rehearsal rooms and make some noise, you know. At that time, we were heavily influenced by the Manic Street Preachers. So it was very different sound. We'd spray painted slogans on our t-shirts, and we had eyeliner and, you know, glitter and feather boas and all the rest of it. Bit cringe now, you know. Thankfully, we kind of evolved before we ever did a first gig. But they'd come down to London and I'd go up to Sheffield, and we roped in a few drummers. I roped in my housemate, Yuri, who actually is BBC Young BBC Two Young Musician of the Year for violin, not for drums. But he was he's from Russia, and yeah, lovely guy, by the way. He was mad into like rock music, like kind of 80s hair rock. But he could drum. He could pick up anything and make something. Pick up a plant pot and make music out of it. It's like that John Lennon thing, you know, give me a tuba, I'll get something out of it. You know, I'm just a musician. Great, good drummer, actually really good drummer. So we started doing gigs with him. We were called Panacea back then. We thought that was a bit cringy name, so we went for an even cringier name. But the reason we were called Special Needs is because the three of those guys in Sheffield University were kind of like loners, like kept to themselves, and they'd be walking through the courtyard of the university with their guitars over their back, and they'd hear people shouting "Special Needs" out the window at them. So we had this idea to sort of embrace it, and you know, because I think now in this age where you know there's a lot more sensitivity about language and stuff, we wouldn't have called ourselves Special Needs. And actually, looking back, it was a stupid thing too.
Yeah, because I was reading a story about maybe in hindsight, yeah, you would have changed your name, because something about an A&R man like refused to talk to you because of the name or something.
Absolutely. He at this point now, so this is skipping a bit, obviously. There was at least one A&R guy who just outright wouldn't listen to the recordings, like because of the name. You know what I mean? And we were stubborn about it. But anyway, yeah, so just going back to that little timeline a bit, was eventually after they finished university, moved back to London, and then we went through a few more drummers, and then we finally met Neil, because we'd started putting on a club night in Acton because we couldn't get gigs. And Neil was just fantastic. Like, he's still probably the greatest drummer I've ever worked with, you know. And that's not to besmirch any of the other ones, obviously. Nick was amazing. Loads of them were really good, but Neil was special, still is special. And then we started doing gigs in London. The Bullet Gate was the first one. And and just bit by bit, we'd do the odd gig here and there, put the club nights on. And then we met Sarah and Nadia, who did this fanzine called Pyrrha. Really, really sort of active on the scene, girls, finger on the pulse at the time. They kind of knew everyone. They knew John Kennedy, the XFM, and those journalists and things like that. And they kind of championed us and gave our demo to John Kennedy, and he played it on XFM. We didn't know. We just got a text from them saying, put on XFM tonight, and we're hearing your stuff on the radio for the first time. Yeah. And then we started doing more and more gigs, and, you know, did a few down at the Rhythm Factory, Libertines, and other, you know, bands like that. And gradually, we just noticed there was more people coming to the gigs bit by bit. And then, and then eventually, after, you know, a bit more time passed, I can skip some of the excess stuff, and got offered Pop Tones to put up our single, and Alan McGee. And it just kind of went from there. And then that scene was burgeoning more and more. And it was a double-edged sword, really, because on one hand, you could see the value of being associated to the scene. But as every, sort of editorial about us seemed to mention that scene and mention the Libertines, it kind of became a bit of an albatross, you know, because we didn't feel that we were similar to the Libertines. We didn't feel we were on the same sort of idealistic path as them. Do you know what I mean? We had kind of grander notions musically. I mean, that's not to say the Libertines are a really good band, but, you know, if you listen to our album, that we've got, you know, we've got violins and pianos on some of the songs, and we wanted it to go bigger. We wanted to get that kind of big Phil Spector-y kind of sound, but we were five white guys with guitars, and we were kind of hoping that bit by bit we could make it bigger and more grand and all the rest of it. Still, you know, playing, you know, indie rock music at the time, if you want to label it like. That A&R guy was just hilarious. It's just, and it was just common. And when we were, even the people we had working for us when we on Universal, it was felt there was a little bit of reluctance that they had to do it. You know what I mean? We had a a press agent and a booking agent and a radio plugger and all the rest of it. And some of them were better than others or more committed than others. But otherwise, I just felt, I don't want to really, I'll do the basics with this band, to paraphrase Roy Keane again. But I don't think we were pushed. We never got any major tour supports, things like that. You know what I mean? We still did, you know, a lot of the good things that other bands do, like, you know, Glastonbury and Wireless Festival at Hyde Park and NME tours and singles charted. So, like, you know, we had a good ride, like, but I always really, really feel that the name held us back, you know. It's just like, but I don't really have many regrets. I kind of believe in, like, you know, the butterfly effect, and if you make a minor change at some point in your life, it affects things down the line. And I'm happy where I am now. I'm living with my partner out here, doing up a house, you know, looking to into the future. And if you'd made any changes to my life back then, I wouldn't be here, you know. So gotta be philosophical about things.
Just going back to that club night you started then, like, what year was that?
I mean, to call it a club night, it's maybe a little bit of an exaggeration, but right. I mean, it was basically, I was living in Acton. I think the other guys were living at Greenford and Sudbury and wherever. And we were kind of sick of just, like, pestering venues and promoters for gigs and just getting nothing back. So let's do it ourselves. So we approached this guy, Alistair, who used to run the George and Dragon in Acton, and he had this big room out the back. So we decided to, let's say once a week, we'll just play and put some of the bands on. It's funny, really, because some of the, we actually, I think Dustin's Bar Mitzvah, I think we gave them their first ever gig. They were from Acton as well. We kind of, you know, formed a little bit of a friendship with them. They're, you know, they're funny lads, nice lads. Also Martin from Selfish, I don't know if I can swear on this one.
Yeah, go for it. Yeah.
Selfish Cunt. Martin came in, did a gig there under a very different incarnation. It was a friend of mine, American friend of mine, Kim, she was playing guitar and he was singing, sitting on stools. It was much more Moldy Peaches than Selfish Cunt, do you know what I mean? But yeah, we put on loads of Miss T and the Japanese tourists who used to come down and play with us. And anyway, yeah, so we just, some nights would be 100 people there, other nights would be 20 people there. We did one night, ridiculously, where we got four bands from Wales. I don't know why we ever did that. And they thought, London, mate, you know, we're going to play in London, you know. And, they started playing the theme tune from Only Fools and Horses. Like, and there was, yeah, it was quite funny. But then, you know what, like, it's, I always used to say, and I probably still maintain it, that, like, no matter where you're playing, no matter who you're playing to, if there's only five people in the room, you never know who those people are. You know what I mean? And so it comes back. I mean, one night we were there and Saul Goldperin was there, who managed Suede, or just didn't manage, or Suede's record label, Nude Records. We talked to him. We didn't end up going with Nude Records, but, like, that's something I would say to bands. I think always give your all, because you never know who's in the room, you know. But yeah, that club night, it was fun, you know. We used to DJ as well, and then there was a dog who used to come around drinking beer out of, you know, little tumblers, big Alsatian dog. Yeah. It was just all crazy. I can't believe it's so long ago either when I think about it. Yeah
So what's that, like, early 2000s?
That would be 2002, I think. 2002, actually. Yeah, I know, because I got fired from my job during the 2002 World Cup. There was those Irish people working in the office, and we went up to watch Ireland against Saudi Arabia, was it? And I just rang the editor of the paper asking if we could have another hour, and he got really angry at me and made a big row. And then I said, "Oh, I quit." I think, and I know that it was around that period. And then we started, because I had more freedom. And I remember. For a while, and then we put that night on, and it was like, yeah. So during my days, I was kind of organizing flyers and putting up posters around Acton and things like that. And yeah, so it was fun, and it just felt like, well, you know what, at least we're doing something. That was around the time we met Neil, because I think Neil had just come to that, to one of those nights, because Neil for us was a game changer. Up until that, we were very loose. I mean, even we had any old drummer, it was really, and Neil was the glue that held it all together, to kind of use a, as soon as he came in, like, everything got tighter, you know. And then when you're playing tightly as a unit, once you got that down, then you're able to kind of experiment a bit more and come up with other ideas, and Andrew was especially, we all used to write, Phil, Daniel, Andrew, myself. Andrew was prolific. He was like really, he spent most of the evenings at home writing songs. He was obsessed, you know. He was really, yeah, very, very focused in it. So he always had new songs. And then within 6 months, we were playing a whole totally different songs that we'd been playing at the very start. We, you know, we kind of evolved musically and went through so many different like influences. You know, obviously there's the Mannix thing and Suede and people like that at the start. And then we kind of like, there was a Pavement period, like where Andrew was into Pavement and, yeah, we also listened to Pavement, and it became a bit more, you know, I don't know if you know that kind of style of stuff. It's just a little bit more obtuse. And then there was the, like, you know, so we had this vision of being like the Ronettes, you know. We had if you listen to the album, you hear the doo-wops and things like that. And we started going down that road a bit more. And that kind of stuck with us then, you know. And then the idea was then to get getting a bit bigger, and so on the album there's a few songs with like violins and things like that. Yeah, so I don't know where I'm going with this now.
Sorry,
talked about the club night anyway. So yeah,
you mentioned like you don't know who's going to be at the gig. Was it like a personal thing with Alan McGee where he saw you and was like, right, do you want a single deal?
It's quite a long time ago and the specifics are, you know, a bit hazy, but I just remember I'd gone down to Death Disco and I'd met him a bunch of times by that stage, and I think there was a lot of bands on that scene. There was the Others and the Paddingtons and the Unstrung, and he, you know, I think he signed quite a lot of them for single deals at least at first, and then on the basis of how well the singles went, I think, you know, then Mercury came to him with this Universal, this idea to put a bit more into it and get these bands to do albums, you know. So we were one of those bands. But I don't remember a specific day where we sat down and said, I think it's all good. I want you to sing, you know. Alan was, I still love Alan. I mean, this, you know, this, what a character, you know, like, but yeah, it was, I just, yeah, we got a manager by that point, a brilliant guy called Z Ahmed. I must see, at some point. I haven't seen him for ages. He did a lot of the talking to people at that stage. I was just busy, you know, sort of floating around London and drinking a lot too much and all the rest of it. But I was making connections, like, so. Was that but yeah, so it was cool, you know. I mean, it was just nice, you know, to see all your CDs printed and then see them in HMV, and you know, like that's us, you know. Like, I remember my mother getting very excited when she saw it in HMV in Cork, you know, like, and telling all her friends and getting them to buy it and stuff, and didn't chart in Ireland, by the way. It was a funny time, you know.
Yeah, Death Disco, like, kind of, what was that like? Because it obviously sounds like the ultimate kind of indie club night.
Yeah, I mean, it was like you'd never know who was going to be there or who was going to DJ, and it was usually really packed. I remember like the first time I knew that we were going somewhere with it was like we were playing one night, and okay, I went out to, I don't know, whatever reason, I went out of the venue for, and I came back and there was like literally a queue going around the corner. I thought, Christ almighty, they're here for us. You know what I mean? And it's like, that was the first time I remember thinking, God, we got some sort of fan base now, you know? And then people like the next day telling me they just couldn't get in. And it's like, I know it's not exactly Wembley Stadium, the Nottingham Arts Club, but we packed a fair few people in there. And it was great. I always remember when we did Death Disco, I'd always crowd surf to the very back of the room. And then, you know, we crowd surf back to the front again, and other people would be as well. It was so hot in there. It was really, really hot and sweaty. I think one of those places where we all had to get our tops off, you know. Yeah.
And am I right in thinking you were quite close with other bands like The Rocks, The Barbs and The Cherubs? Did you do a lot of touring with them?
We did, yeah. So I think the Rocks was the first real connection we made with another band. I just randomly saw them at Dingwalls one day, and I just loved James's energy, and Sarah looked really cool, and Margaret looked really cool, and they were just a really kind of a fun band. And James climbing up anything he could climb up. And I went and spoke to them after the gig and just told them how much I loved it. And then I can't remember now if I told them the band I was in, and they already knew and they liked this one of the songs. But we formed a very quick friendship. And at one point, I was very close to James and Sarah and Maro and all the rest of them. I'm still in good terms with all of them. I stayed with Sarah in New York there a few years ago. That was, yeah. So on my birthday, they came and did a gig in my bedroom. My band played and our special needs played and the Rocks played. Neighbors weren't that happy about it, obviously. And then we, started doing gigs together in London, and then we organized a tour. It was funny, there was a tour with us and the Rocks and the Barbs, and it was called the Evil Rocks Tour, because the Barbs had this evil shtick, even though they're the least evil people you could ever imagine. But and I love the Barbs as well, by the way. Really lovely people as well, Tim and Amy, and the other guys. But we kind of thought Evil Rocks, and then where does special needs fit in there? But anyway, so there's always a little bit of friction and tension with bands and stuff, and trying to get yourself up noticed and relevant on the thing. And we play certain places, and some reason Stockton, everyone loved the Barbs, and we played after the Barbs, and the room was full when the Barbs were on. We went into the dressing room to get our stuff and come back, stage room was empty. And it's like, but then other places there'd be people to see us, and then other places there'd be people to see the Rocks, and then Cherubs as well. I don't think we didn't play as many gigs with Cherubs. We never toured with Cherubs, but we did go to Norway after we reformed to do a gig in Bergen for the lads out there. Great guys, yeah. Yeah, I always, I've been asked to answer some questions for a book that's been written as well. And one of the questions is, who do you think is the most underrated band of that period? And I would say Cherubs. I think Ståle was, a really special frontman. I think they should have been higher up. But yeah, so some great memories as well. I mean, those tours were fun,
Then obviously you mentioned the likes of the Libertines. Obviously you get, like you say, you get a bit of a label in that scene, but must have been some pretty good nights, or pretty memorable nights with them, I guess.
Yeah, so, I mean, one of the things about the Libertines was, obviously there's this forum that Libertines fans used to go on. I think it's commonly known as .org now. I mean, obviously, as if it's the only relevant thing that's got a .org, for the domain. But hundreds, even thousands of people would go on that forum. And it was a really good vehicle for getting our band a bit more known by people that could come to gigs and things. So I didn't join up to go on there for cynical reasons. I just was interested. I quite liked Libertines. And I don't know if you know this, but there's an interesting reason why there was any connection in the first place, is that when we were called Panacea, we were mulling over new different band names. And this is 1998, right? Or 99. And one of the names we considered was the Libertines. And then we heard about this other band that was already called the Libertines. We were just starting to do first gigs in Filthy McNasty. So we went down to Filthy McNasty's. And I remember it was me, Daniel, my girlfriend at the time, a friend of hers, and maybe a couple of other friends of mine, and about seven other people in Filthy McNasty's at this time. It was quiet, and the Libertines were playing. It was like their night, and they had Scarborough Steve and the Rabbi, and it was crazy. It looked nothing really like what the Libertines ended up being like. And from my memory, Peter didn't sing much at all. He was mostly just standing there playing, and Carl did a bit of singing, and it was a different kind of lineup and everything. And we just thought it was quite funny. And we didn't, I, on that, looking at them that night, we didn't think that they were going to go anywhere. But we had moved on from the idea. The Libertines was just a fleeting idea, and there was loads of other band names we considered. It was just one of many. So we didn't go with that. We went with Special Needs. And then a couple of years later, you're saying, wow, we've got these bands that we saw in Fleeting Mac in front of the NME. So how did that happen? And then I saw them, I went down to see them somewhere, and it was very different. And they were tighter and slicker, and it was still raucous and ramshackle, but it was a lot more cohesive than it had been there for the Nasties that night, you know. Now, if I'm misremembering aspects of this, forgive me, it's a long time ago, but I think I got most of it right. And then, yeah, so just because the Libertines were kind of the dominant band on in the London scene around those days, it was inevitable that there'd be overlap. There'd be, you know, you'd bump into them, or people associate to them, or people like them, and then, yeah, obviously some of them liked us, and then and we started getting more people talking about us on that .org forum, and yeah, so that's the kind of went from that then. And then, yeah, we started playing the odd gig with them down in the Rhythm Factory, and we were like touted amongst bands to go and support them in bigger gigs. But I think obviously one of the defining factors of if you support Libertines and the bigger gigs was if you're mates with them. And I think there were other bands who were a lot closer. I mean, I often think there's a misconception about how close I personally was to the Libertines and stuff. And the rest of the band, really no association with them or most of the other bands I'm seeing. I wasn't close enough to Peter, and I certainly never wanted to be. I don't mean that as an insult. I was like, oh, I'm going to start being friends with Pete Doherty. It's like, you know, I'm not like that. If you know, you form a friendship based on organic activity. I saw a lot of bands that would pursue Peter. They'd follow him around the country and, you know what I mean, just like turn up at the gigs and trying to get backstage and try to hang out with them. I never ever thought I'm going to do that. Like, it's not in my character to do that. I've had plenty of interactions with him, and more Carl. I mean, I was better friends with Carl, you know. I still got Carl's number and phone, do you know what I mean? I talked to him occasionally, especially because, you know, I used to work at Nambuka there until a few years ago, and, you know, Carl used to come along and do stuff there. But so the Libertines, yeah, it was like, yeah, they were the dominant band on that scene, and then the benefit of being on that forum and people talking about you is that a lot of their fans would then come and go to your gigs, and then that helped other bands develop. So it was good. It was good for. And at that time, there was like a lot of interest in guitar music, and a lot of bands being signed. And then you'd go out, you'd pop into a bar in Camden, and you'd see four or five sort of friends or acquaintances that are in other bands, and that this week they're in the charts, or you know, they've got an XFM session, or they've got a BBC session, or whatever, you know. It was just like, a lot of people that I knew were doing quite well, and you had other bands as well around the time. So there was other scenes as well. There was like the Block Party and sort of Franz Ferdinand, and there was even the Darkness, you know what I mean, like him or hate him, they were fun. You know what I mean? But they were doing very well, and you know, as I say, like, you know, and then the Cribs started doing better, and you know what I mean, other bands then just kind of spread. And then of course you had the issues of the Libertines becoming inactive at periods, and then, you know what I mean, it was so it was a funny time.
Was there Razorlight another one that quite liked you guys and got you to support?
Yeah, to be honest, that's the thing. Razorlight were probably more instrumental in helping us. No question about it, actually, because Johnny really liked us. Johnny would always come to our gigs, and we get a. Oh, I remember we're doing a session at XFM with John Kennedy, and it's like Johnny texts me and like, "Outside, can I come in?" It's like, "Which one?" He brought us to Belfast to do a gig with them, the Rizla Inspired By tour. It was, and it was nice because like, he was saying that he was inspired by us, and he really admired Andrew as well, who wrote a lot of our songs, and he just liked his character. And I think, we supported them a lot. I mean, I'm still friendly with still friendly with Carl and Bjorn. In fact, they both played on my solo album that I have yet to release, but we'll come out at some point. Carl did all the bass. Bjorn did some nice lead guitar stuff. But they were, yeah, and we'd support Razorlight at various shows, and we put on one at Hammersmith Palette. Not Hammersmith Palette, Hammersmith Working Men's Club, sorry. Freudian slip there. And Razorlight came and played that one. And so, yeah, they were good. He mentioned us in the NME and BBC interviews and things like that. Like, so he was a fan as well as everything else, yeah.
You know, at the time, and since you're obviously here, mixed things about Johnny Burrell, but you're saying, like, you know, you obviously got on with him.
Well, it wasn't without ripples. I'm not going to go into some of the details about certain things, but it wasn't all good. But overall, I think, I don't know, confidence is one thing and arrogance is another thing. And I think Johnny was very confident, and I did maybe overspend arrogance sometimes. But I don't know, in this day and age, that's what gets people ahead, and it's like a reality of life. And I mean, I think being this, do you think I'm good? Oh, thank you very much. It just doesn't get you anywhere. You know what I mean? So I think you've got to admire that in a way. You know what I mean? Like, it's a difficult one because I've always tried to be, you know, humble. Not that I've had any major reason to not be humble. I'm not, you know what I mean? But yeah, Johnny, overall, I think Johnny is a pretty good guy. You know what I mean? Everyone's got their flaws, but I respect for him. You know, like, I think looking back, he could write songs, you know. That first album, actually, the thing about the first album, the Razorlight album, is that I really love the demo versions. And I think when they recorded the album, they cleaned it up a lot. And some of those songs just, we lost that initial energy, that sort of garage energy, you know what I mean? It's still a good album, but I actually just prefer the rougher demo versions. And for a while they were everywhere. I mean, I remember I was walking through a supermarket, you know, one of those shopping centers, and as I'm walking down past one shop, there's one Razorlight song playing, and then I walk down past another shop and there's another Razorlight song playing, a different one than another shop. And you know, just, yeah, it was mad for a while for them, and then it just kind of, which I didn't see that coming. I thought Razorlight got to a certain point where they would then go on to bigger and bigger things. Then he changed the lineup. I think it was a big mistake. Got rid of the Swedish lads, and but yeah, so that's the Razorlight thing. I still like Razorlight. You know, I don't listen to a lot of the music from those days, but now you've put it in my head that I might go and listen to some Razorlight at some point.
No, it's one of them, like I'm the same. I wouldn't, you know, think to listen to them, but then I remember being in the car not long ago, and I think Stumble and Fall came on. It's just, yeah, like, well, yeah. You can't deny that this is definitely a banger of a song. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. I think there's a few bangers on that first album, you know. And I think maybe the point where he started to become self-aware was the America. America. But yeah, I think, do you know what? They made an impact, and that's all you can hope for as a band, isn't it? You know what I mean? When you start off with your friends thinking, oh, let's be in a band, you want the ultimate goal is to make an impact, and they made an impact, so fair play to them, you know.
No, definitely. And I think the original lineup might be back together now, is it?
Oh, really?
I think so, yeah.
I don't know about that, yeah. But I'm going to Google it after this.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 22 Gram Pod. If Naughty's guitar music is your thing, then you might enjoy our Patreon page, where for £3 a month you will get access to the following series. The Naughties Deep Dive, where we go through the likes of the Stalking Pete Doherty documentary in painful detail. My favourite 2000s album, where patrons and other guests come on to talk about their favourite album of the era. Legend or Landfill, in which we go through Enemy's top 10 albums of each year from 2001 and see if we think they are indeed legendary or for the landfill. Unsigned Stories, where we chat to bands that didn't quite make it in terms of signing that elusive record deal. We also have Fan Stories, where I talk to people about their memories and opinions on all things Naughties Indie. You also get early access to any main podcast episodes, and it's also worth checking out the YouTube page where you can see extended video versions of the interviews as well as plenty of other bits of commentary and opinion. All links are in the description. Now back to the pod. Talking about the whole scene and everything, and I was listening to Martin's In A Fix. Was that kind of a bit of a comment on that scene at the time?
It was, yeah. It was... So, yeah, we used to write songs about certain things. And one of the things that... We did kind of hate that leaky kind of, I'm on the guest list and blah, 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 I'm going out to the after party, blah, 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 you know. It's not as barbed as some people think it is, because, I mean, there was a specific person that I'm actually quite fond of that it was kind of aimed towards, and it wasn't a damning indictment of them as a person in general. It was just a little comment about that aspect of their personality, and it was never meant to be hurtful. You know what I mean? It was just meant to be a little bit, you know, a little bit of a wind up, but yeah, we always thought, because the rest of the guys were never into that sort of thing at all. I mean, I would go to after parties and things like that, and just because I like, you know, drinking for starters. I mean, I don't drink anymore, but 4 years since I last touched alcohol. But you know, I thought they were fun and things like that, and it's, you know, like it's nice to be on the guest list. Do you know what I mean? But some people were obsessed with it. Some people was like, it was like the way they lived their life was, I'm just want to be on the guest list for everything. I just want to be fraternizing with all these, you know, indie stars and stuff like that. And like, well, you know, that's the Martin's In A Fix fretting about the guest list. You know, it's like, yeah, it was, yeah. I don't want to say too much more about it because, yeah, I don't want to insult anyone. But it was never meant to be vicious. It was just a gentle little rib. You know what I mean? Like,
even I remember like plenty of that going on. But I was probably guilty of some of it, to be fair.
Yeah, probably all were. You know, I mean, I can think of times when the rest of the special needs guys were on guests. So it's like, but listen, what person can stand the hand of the heart and say I've never been a hypocrite? I don't think many of us can.
No, exactly. Yeah,
times, you know,
it's a thing that comes with age as well, I guess. Like, you're obviously changing your perspective all the time, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I was having this thought last night. It's just, you know, when it was, we started off in the band, it's like, oh yeah, you get to meet lots of girls, and you know what I mean. It's like, you know, like, yeah, go to parties and take drugs and all this stuff. I mean, right now the idea starts to got different ambition in life now. You want to be happy and you want to do fulfilling things, and still making music, still writing music, and haven't been performing for a while now. I'll get rid of this beard because I think I don't have too many wrinkles or anything, you know, like I always feel I don't know, I'm aged towards myself, but it's like I don't want to look like an old git on stage, you know what I mean? So yeah. It just makes me sad, you know, to think of, I mean, you gotta be philosophical about everything, and like getting older is just a reality, you know. It's one of those things that happens. And my cat is trying to get in the back door, by the way. I have this cat that opens the back door. She jumps up and pulls the handle down.
Right,
let's go in. But,
yeah, she get on YouTube, mate.
I did, yeah. It might kick off at some point.
Yes.
But yeah, no, I mean, like, I you know, I haven't performed for a while now, but I can still sing, you know. I'm looking to get an audition for Hamilton. That's what I want to do. I know every word to Hamilton now. A friend of mine is involved in it, and he got us some tickets there like years ago, and I just kind of became obsessed with it. It's like, it's just, I think it's amazing. It's just like, it's like modern Shakespeare, you know? So yeah, I think I could probably play King George III. I'll get an audition first. Yeah. Yeah, it's a bit more appropriate for me now. You know, sort of thing about Martin's in effects. You know, seems a bit irrelevant now. But yeah, I mean, the whole I think this the indie music scene is like, because I think it's probably gone, and it's probably gone forever. I mean, like, now I know that there's people like, you know, like Mikey John, this feeling is trying to keep it going and stuff. He's doing his best, like he's putting on the, you know, bands and things like that. But I don't know, I just think the general public's appetite for that sort of music is, I don't know, I think they've probably had enough of it now. Like, you know, rap is probably, that's what people listen to now. That's, they're the rock stars of this era now. You know what I mean? And there just doesn't seem that much, anything that glamorous about guys playing guitars anymore, you know, to the general public. You know what I mean? It's like, and even myself, it's like I find myself gravitating away from guitar music more. It's not to say I'm not like looking at me and listening to rap. I'm not like I don't know if it's just so much harder. And the internet really kind of changed a lot. You know, the internet made it. When it came along and you could put up your music on the internet, like, wow, you can reach people all over the world. Like, but then what we kind of didn't realize at the time was, yeah, so can everyone else. And then home recording software kind of came along at the same time. So now everyone else in the world is recording stuff. So instead of having, in the old days when you had to put the legwork in, you'd go to a recording studio, lug your guitars and your drum kit there, and then spend 2 days recording 4 songs, get a tape or a CD, which you've got to physically reproduce and hand out to different people. That was work, and people, and you had to pay for this as well. And people, you know, you need to be committed to that. You know, nowadays you get recording software, you record your music with loops and all the rest of it, you stick it up, and then there's millions of people making music. And nowadays, trying to be recognized, I kind of liken it to, there's an open audition at Wembley Stadium, but everyone's going to sing at the same time. One guy going around trying to see who were the good ones, you know, and there's this cacophony of noise around. So, you know, getting recognized now is much more of a lottery. It's much more of, we will pick you out, make you famous, rather than you're good. We'll identify that, you know. It's just the reality of the times now, you know. It's like, it's the music moguls now are more powerful than ever, you know. They kind of I think what a lot of people don't really understand is that the way we consume music as consumers, it's much less about supply and demand. In the case of, in the old days, I mean, you know, the Beatles, like, people would buy their music and then they'd get more and more famous. Nowadays, like, you're told who's going to be famous first. The record executives will pick them out, cultivate them, package them, put them on the radio, pay radio pluggers to make sure the songs are played, gets into your head, and you're told what to listen to all intents and purposes. I mean, as mainstream music consumption goes, you know what I mean? Like, obviously, people who are passionate about music will seek out their own stuff, but what the general masses listen to, it's never been more controlled than ever. And it's, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I don't believe in flat earth. I'm one of those people that, you know, every single news source I look at, I've got to check whether it's right or not. This is what I've experienced, and what you see happening, you know. And especially now, when these record executives perceive that a type of music is no longer fashionable, less and less is invested in it. And that's what the state the guitar music is in at the moment, you know. It's just not trendy. And you can say trendy anymore, but so they're not signing that many guitar bands. And, you know.
Is that how you recorded your new album then? Was that a bit of a home thing?
No, I went down to One Cut Studio down in Brixton with John Clayton, who's a brilliant producer, even though he calls himself an engineer, but he's a great producer, and he's a multi-instrumentalist as well. So, but the problem is I had to pay for it myself. I don't have a record label paying for it. So I kind of ran out of money after a while, or at least I couldn't justify donating any more money to the thing. But I still owe him money. You know what I mean? I still haven't paid him everything that for the recording, which I will, if you're watching, John, I'm going to get back onto that very soon. It's not astronomical amounts or anything. So it still has to be mastered, even though the recording process is finished. I started this 6 years ago, but it's just like then the other things got in the way. It was a pandemic. I've got a day job now as well, obviously, so I've got to, you know, do that. But I don't know if you've had a chance to listen to it, but I quite like it. It's like, I think you gotta make it for yourself first and like it yourself. And then hopefully other people will like it. And hopefully at some point enough people will like it that somebody will give you money. I'm not necessarily talking about myself here, but other people will give you enough money that you can live on it and make music yourself. And that process is becoming a lot harder to get into nowadays. It's more about the way public consumes media in general. They want short, sharp sound bites, bang, you know, like the TikTok generation. They don't want to watch anything that's longer than 30 seconds. You know what I mean? They don't want to listen to an album. They want to listen to a song. You know, it's like, and it's young people, they are the future, to quote Whitney Houston, you know? So that's the way it's going. I think the era of the album is probably on its way out. You know what I mean? It's like most people, like my partner now, the way she listens to music, she has certain artists that she likes, but it'll be songs that they'll release and stuff. Like, she's mad into this guy, Oliver Tree. Now, I don't know if you've heard of him, but
I think I've heard the name.
Yeah, he's got this song, Life Goes On, and she's been playing it over and over again. It's quite a good, catchy song, you know? But that's kind of the way people are listening to things now. They'll have playlists on Spotify, and there'll be multiple artists. And, you know, in the old days, you'd make a CD based on tracks that you got from all the other albums, but you'd have those albums, and then you'd copy it onto your thing, and then you'd, you know... nowadays, like, people get Spotify playlists, and you know, they get alerts that a new artist has got a new song, and it's not to say that albums will stop being recorded altogether. It's just, it's not the way that people will consume music as much, I think, you know, because you'd always get purists, and vinyls made a comeback, you know, but the vinyl making a comeback hasn't been for practical reasons. It's just been kind of nostalgia, and it's nice. It feels nice, and it sounds nice, and it's more tangible, isn't it? You know, to hold a record in your hands. And it's like, although even I, like, by the time I started listening to music as a kid, it was tapes and CDs. And, you know, we did have a record player growing up with some strange stuff. Like, my mother had lots of Jose Feliciano albums and the Lost Horizon soundtrack and Tommy Steele and Nancy Sinatra and all sorts of weird-ish kind of stuff. Not insanely weird stuff. My mother, you know, it's not like Throbbing Gristle was her number one band. But I've forgotten what I was talking about.
Just want to cover a few things from back in the day. I read something about, basically you said something about you punching Andrew on stage whilst in the Batman outfit. Is that right?
I knew you were going to ask me that. So, I think it was a birthday gig we'd agreed to do at Infinity, and I turned up worst for wear, and a friend of mine, Whiskey, had a Batman costume, and he thought it'd be a fun idea for me to wear the Batman costume for the gig. So I did, and after about a song or two, I felt, I don't want to wear this anymore. I started taking it off on stage. I was taking my time, and the band started playing. Andrew started singing the next song. I'm like, what are you doing? You know, I was all over the place. And he kind of hits me with his guitar, so I just punched him, you know. It wasn't a particularly good part. I was drunk and kind of, the irony about alcohol is it makes you more willing to fight, but less able to do so, you know. It was just a little bit of a fracas, and then we got separated. The gig ended, obviously. And then the next day, Andrew rang me up, and we both apologized for our part in it. And I said, I'm sorry, I got to sort myself out a bit. And but we did think, like, do you know what? People will remember that. We'll talk about that in years to come. Whereas if nothing happened, it would be like we'd have forgotten that gig ever happened. Yeah. But I mean, I was messy back then, you know, and it's like that messiness kind of stayed with me for quite a long time. It held me back. There's no question about it, you know. I'd say about 4 years ago, 4 years and about 3 months now since I last had a drink. And I feel so much better. Like, it's, you know, I think when alcohol, you can't control it. That's when you got to stop it. And I spent 20 years trying to control it, you know. Oh, just have water in between each alcoholic drink and all the rest of it, and go through periods where I wasn't touching it, and then something would happen and I'd end up in a 3-day bender. Do you know what I mean? It's like, and I think that's a question that people should ask themselves, can I control it? And if the answer is I'm not sure, then I think knock on the head, because it's not worth it. You know what I mean? And people will have regrets. I have lots of regrets, but I mean, I kind of wish I'd stopped drinking a lot earlier. I wish I'd stopped drinking around the special needs days, really, because I would have been more focused, would have been more able to participate in aspects of the things I didn't participate enough in. I mean, when we started off, I was, you know, writing songs with them and everything. And then towards the end, there wasn't that much material I was really writing. You know, by the end, it was mostly Andrew, Daniel and Phil. And I regret that. I regret that, you know, that music, I don't feel an ownership as much of it as I should have, that I'm just singing on it, you know. And then, you know, obviously I've gone on to record. I've been in other bands where I wrote all the songs, and then bands where I wrote some of the songs. So after Special Needs, I formed the Refusenics in Cork. We moved to London and then changed the name to the Bon Vivants with a different lineup. And then I formed a band with my sister, Amy, and some other friends, Andy, Elian, Patrick, Daddy, Arms. And we got a little record deal with Rocket Girl, put out an album. But yeah, it's like, I think drink held me back, you know, definitely. It's like, I know it's something that a lot of people are often uncomfortable talking about, but I kind of made no bones about it, you know. I think I would have achieved more if I hadn't been drinking so much for such a long time. But yeah, you live and learn, and life's always about trying to make improvements, you know. So that's a big one. And now I'm, you know, living here with my partner Ashton, and we have a home. We're trying to make that an even nicer home, and a lot of work involved. When we moved in here like last year, we just pretty much strip it out and start again, you know. And still a year and 3 months down the line, we've still got rooms to finish. Do you know what I mean? So it's nice. It's nice to have that, you know. And I wouldn't have it if I was still drinking. That's the segue back into that, you know. Of course I had fun, you know, back in the day when I was, you know, going around just in those days, you know. There was scenes everywhere in London. There was the New Cross scene. There was gigs happening out in West London, North London, South London, Central London, Shoreditch. And we'd be flitting from one place to the other every night. We'd go to do Notting Hill, and then you'd go back into Central London. You'd go off to Shoreditch. You know what I mean? It's like something was happening every night of the week. You know, and you'd your regular mainstays. You had like Frog on the Saturday. You had the Queens of Noise stuff on the Friday. You'd Trash on Monday. You had Death Disco on Wednesday. Do you know what I mean? It was like every night there's something else you go to that was a regular thing, and then there was other things. It was like, and there was really an awful lot of fun, because I'd hate for this to come across that, oh my god, just bitterness and regret. I don't have any bitterness, and I don't have any real regrets, apart from, you know, certain things I think you could have done differently. But overall, we achieved what a lot of bands, you know, starting off would like to achieve. And you know, if you know, even just being asked to do this today, people still remember. It's like, so you made a little impact, and that's all we can do, you know. It's like, that's all anyone wants to do, just make an impact in some way, you know what I mean? But it's career-wise or, you know, romantically or something. That's what we're all striving to do, isn't that?
I was reading about competition you did for Channel 4, the Road to V Festival or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We didn't win that, but I remember it was at the Islington Academy. and I couldn't hear myself. Like the monitors were really bad.
And is it just one gig?
It was one gig. What happened was we were supposed to do, we were on tour at the time, and we were down to do a gig in Biker in Newcastle, you know, Biker Grove. And we got there, and there was just some weird vibe there. And like, it was quite a rough area. And we had the Channel 4 thing the next day. And I think it was like, they hadn't sold many tickets. And we went out to get food or something. And there was like these kind of kids just kind of around. It was just kind of, I don't care about that. But we thought, you know what, should we ditch this one? So we pulled the gig and we drove back down to London. And the next day we had to go to the Islington Academy and record this thing for Channel 4. And I couldn't hear myself. And then we didn't win. And I, to this day, I still think it might be because I watched the video of myself singing backwards, and you can hear I'm not singing in tune. It's just not that great. I think Young Knives won it. And we ended up touring with them as well for NME, I think the following few months or something. They were good lads as well. They were a good band that kind of been forgotten about. But so there was that Channel 4 thing. But yeah, that's why we didn't play in Biker. I think Ant and Dec were there waiting for us as well. They were really disappointed, you know?
Yeah, and Jeff Mann was it. But yeah, you played at some good festivals that year, like saw the O2 Wireless in Hyde Park.
That was nice, you know, like Hyde Park, you know, sort of an iconic place for bands to play, you know. I know it's just a big field generally, but you know, there's a gig there, it's a good atmosphere. I've seen a lot of good gigs at Hyde Park, and then just to be able to play in the same place, which is nice. And Glastonbury, obviously. The only problem with the Glastonbury thing was we were on the same time as Brian Wilson. It's like everyone wanted to see Brian Wilson and we couldn't. That was a disappointment. But but it was fun. It was like, you know, like again, see the tent full of people and then down the front. Oh, it was really cute, actually. Like, I remember down the front was all regular fans, and then Lloyd from the Paddington just up against the barriers like that, just watching. I'll never forget that. And I think later on that night, the Paddingtons were playing on the same stage. And if memory serves me correctly, at the end of the gig, I ran on stage and was wrestling with Grant. I think he fractured his rib. Like, yeah, that was a bit messy. And then I woke up next morning in the medical tent. So someone had taken me there. That's, do you know what I mean? You can't, I say you had a good night unless you ended up in the medical tent, you know?
Yeah. I'll have to ask those two about that. Sounds funny.
Yeah.
And then just in terms of labels, like you were, like you say, you got with Mercury to release an album, but it was dropped before you were able to release it or something?
So towards the end of 2005, we were doing tours and we had gigs planned in Italy and France, and another UK tour was being finalised. And then one day our manager comes to us and says, lads, got some bad news. Mercury have decided to release you and several other bands from the contract. What does that mean? It means, well, we can have the album back and go to another label, but they're not going to put any more money in, and our money's pretty much run out. So, yeah, we carried on for maybe a month or two after that, and we dropped the special from the band name, so we were just the Needs at that point. But that stage is way too late, you know. And Z, our manager, you know, sort of touted the album around to every label you can think of. And the feedback from every one of them was really good. Myself and Phil, our bass player, used to joke about it. It's like, yeah, we listened to the album. It's like the best album since the Beatles, but it's just not right for us at the moment. You know what I mean? And it's like, that was kind of that. Okay, I'm exaggerating. Nobody said that, but they were saying it's really good. Really good, we love it, but it's just not right for us at the moment, you know? Nobody put it out at the time. And then we felt we were going backwards. Remember, we did a gig at Elephant and Castle, and there was about a third less people than would normally be at that gig. And we kind of said, lads, I didn't. The rest of them did. We're going backwards here. And they decided that they wanted to call it a day. And then eventually they told me. And we'd already done our last gig. I didn't even know that our last gig was going to be our last gig. So it was quite sad. But then we did, you know. And then a year later, a friend, Innes Riki, a Scottish journalist who used to write for Loaded and other sort of stuff, he contacted Reaction Records, who were interested in putting the album out. And at the time, we thought, well, listen, it's either that or probably never, ever see the light of day. And so we signed the contract and they put the album out then the following year. So we'd been broken up by, I don't know, 8 or 9 months by the time the album came out. It got great reviews. Like, you know, it was pretty much every review was positive. Some of them were glowing, you know. And I still think it's a really good album. I think it might be a little bit overproduced, to be honest. I don't want to insult Ian Grimble there, but obviously these are the songs that I sang for years, and they do seem a little bit at certain points a bit that we got them too tight on the recordings, you know what I mean? I would have liked a little bit of looseness there sometimes, but it's difficult, especially when you're the producer, you're trying to get the best sound you can, trying to get the most polished, good sound. And I love the album. I still think Time to Remember is a great song that's kind of lost in the hubris, you know what I mean? So that album went out then in 2006. And then about 5 years later, we all felt we'd got a little bit of unfinished business, and we decided to reform on the 1st of January, wasn't it, 2011? Because it's a notable day, New Year's Day. And so we played it Proud in Camden, which was packed. It's like, and the atmosphere in there that night was, there was just electricity in the air, you know. It was a lot of anticipation because it's been 5 years since we played. And I think over that time, people thought, yeah, I think they were a good band, you know. And it was just amazing. Just great, really great atmosphere. I mean, there's some videos up on YouTube, and I haven't watched them for a long time, but you can hear the whole venue is singing the songs back. And it's like, it was just really electric. And then we did New York, and we did Norway. We did another tour with Jesse Malin, which was a bit of a weird marriage. I think it was out of convenience because they needed a band that provided a backline for the tour. And then our last gig. So the thing about us as well is we can say that our last ever gig was supporting Bob Dylan.
All right.
It was at the Hop Farm Festival where Bob Dylan was headlining. So I guess that's not a bad way to bow out, you know. Not that I'm a massive Dylan acolyte or anything. Of course I like Bob Dylan, you know, but I'm not a big fan. It was quite fun. That reunion period is quite good. We recorded some new music as well. It was kind of tied up some loose ends, you know.
Yeah, did you know it was going to be kind of a short-lived thing, or did you just see how it was going to go?
Well, initially, it was just going to be one gig. I mean, that was the original plan. And then when that gig went really well, we organized some other gigs, and they went quite well. And then we thought, well, I should record some stuff, and we did. And then the tour thing kind of happened, and thought, yeah. The New York thing happened. Just a friend of ours was determined to put us on in New York. And we'd never played in North America or any part of America, even though we knew we had fans over there. So it was really nice because when we got there, we got there a few days before we were doing the gig, and people had flown in from everywhere. They'd flown in from Texas and Florida, and people had come down from Boston, and these are the ones I know about, you know what I mean? So it was like, wow, do you know what I mean? We're making people get on planes. It's just like, that's a weird feeling that someone's got on the plane to go across America to see you perform on stage. Do you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, it was really great. And that was, again, another fantastic gig at the Bowery Electric in the Lower East Side. Just really cool. Like, I love New York. I've been there quite a few times, and it's a good atmosphere there, you know. That was nice. And it was just, like I say, nice to tie up some loose ends. We'd the only time I'd ever flown to a gig before was to go to Belfast. You know, that was where I got told to take my tie off, because I was on stage and I had a tie with shamrocks on it. And actually, I think you might have heard the little thing that in Belfast, in Northern Ireland, the north of Ireland, whichever way you want to look at it. And I had a white shirt and a black tie with some shamrocks on it. I obviously wasn't thinking. Do you know what I mean? Because I thought, well, I know there's a 50% of this audience will like it. 50% might not like it that much. And somebody just said, shouted to me, take off that tie. So I just thought, you know what? I might as well take off the tie. So I took off the tie. Yeah. So that had been the only time we'd flown to a gig before. And then we did the Norway and New York thing. And it was nice. It was good. I mean, I'd still like to do it again sometime. I mean, I know this year now is 10 years since we last played. I think it might be time to dust off the old microphone at some point. We'll see.
Yeah.
It's hard to know what appetite people have for it, you know, because like we could, you know, and then you got to figure out, well, do we get a 300 capacity venue? Do we get a 1,000 capacity venue? It's like, you know, I would like to do it. I mean, there's no point hiding that. I would like to get on stage and sing the special needs songs again with the other members of special needs, and you know what I mean? So we'll see. We'll see.
Was there a high point of being in special need?
It was all a high point. I mean, I love that band. I suppose the high point would be that, you know, got in the charts. We played Glastonbury. You know, we wrote some really good songs that people, you know, can listen to forever. You know what I mean? Like, it was just nice to do something that people like, you know. I think that's what any band wants. You want to have, I go on Spotify sometimes, our album's on there, and you think you still got several hundred listeners every month, and it's like, that's nice, you know. Even if it's not like thousands, but it's like every month people and other places listen to the music that we made, and I think that's all you can ask for.
Is there anything you'd do differently? Obviously you mentioned the drinking aspect and stuff, but
change the name, number one. That would definitely it's not like, again, honestly, I really want to just have no bitterness. It's just what happened, that's life. You know what I mean? It's I've felt for years that if we had a different name, we would have had a different trajectory. You know, like, I think because I think we had it, we got really tight as a band, you know what I mean, and the songwriting I thought was getting better and better, and I've always thought I can sing and I can perform, you know, as like a front man and stuff, and we could all talk as well, you know, that like we all had a, you know, we, I think we all had personality, and I think we kind of a lot of ingredients that for what could be a popular band, and but we had a stupid name. And that would be a big regret, if you want to call it a regret. But there's no point in regrets. Regret is a kind of a useless emotion. I mean, there's nothing you can do about it. It's like, it's what it is. Just kind of try to do whatever you do next in a better way, you know? Like, we people saying to us, like, oh, God, the name, you know, the name's like, are you sure? I was like, yeah, we're just a bit defiant and a bit stubborn. And Alan McGee, I think, as well. Yeah, I like it. That's good. Yeah. yeah, but anyway, that's what it was. And regrets are kind of pointless.
Always try and get maybe a funny story about the Gallagher brothers, or maybe another big name in music, if we got one.
The Gallagher brothers. I met them both once. Noel, I was putting on the Coral when I was promoting. After show party thing, and I went back. It was an under solo or no bar solo, and I had to go to Dingwall to pick him up. And when I got in there, Noel was in the dressing room, and at this stage I was worse for wear, even though I was running the night. And I was like, Noel, and so I had a good chat with him. And then there's a picture of me and him where I asked, can I get a picture of him? And he's like, the expression on his face. I think the funniest thing, there's two funny things actually. Number one was on an Oxygen Festival in Ireland. And I just ran up to Michael Stipe when I was in the VIP bit. And I gave him a big hug. And he was really nice. But then I walked around the back of the main stage. And Paul Weller is walking my direction. And I've never met Paul Weller in my life. And all of a sudden, he runs towards me. Hey, man, how's it going? And he like, puts his arm around me. He's like, okay. So I think it was very safe and identity, but I kind of got attacked by Paul Weller in a loving way. But no, I never got that from Noel and Liam. They were okay, you know.
It's one of those things where well away, just you go along with it like, yeah, nice one, mate.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so, yeah, I mean, Paul Weller, you know, like, it's... Yeah, it's not like just some random weirdo or anything, but...
It's funny because you hear stories about him being quite hostile, so it's quite funny to hear that he did that.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I was so taken aback. It's like, and I turned to my girlfriend at the time and like, did that really just happen?
Yeah. Where can people, where should people follow or whatever, or look out for your new stuff?
Well, if you want to hear my voice... You can go onto Netflix and watch Sophie, A Murder in West Cork and choose the audio description. That's the most recent thing I've ever done. I mean, right. It's a laugh. I've got the album that I do have it on the internet there somewhere, but I'm not really looking for people to start listening to it yet because I'm still, you know, kind of thinking about trying to get it out there in some way. Just Google my name occasionally and it'll come up. At the moment, the album's still unreleased, but I'll be putting it out at some point. I'm going to get it out this year, one way or another, you know. I don't, you know, the whole thing of, you know, trawling through different, you know, labels to see if one of them wants to put it out. We'll see, but I've got to get it out.
Run, did it, run, did it, run, did it, right.